reasonably close to the right time. All right, first we talked about myths that introduce the spirit of what we're talking about. And then we talked about myths that clarified the idea that mythology is talking about the stuff of the spiritual worlds more than about the material world. In fact, from the material world, it doesn't make a lot of sense. But to a large extent, myths taken from the spiritual world can almost be taken literally, because we literally live in a realm that's filled with gods and fairies and angels and all sorts of other beings. And now we're set to start with something new. But with starting something new, we're going to go right back and tell the very first story that we told, and we're going to tell it all over again, only we're going to accentuate it a little differently. And that's the story of Eurynome. And Eurynome was the original mother or goddess of all things, and she arose from chaos. And being a lover of comfort, she couldn't find any place to rest her feet. So in chaos, what she did is she divided the sky from the water. She was a light stepper. And she danced on the waters. And dancing on the waters, she was able to swirl more. And so she started swirling. And in the sky in which she was located, as she was swirling, there were the winds. And what she did is she caught hold of the north wind, and she rolled it in her hands. And as she rolled the north wind in her hands, it became a serpent. And that serpent was called Ophion. This is the Plesiadian creation story. We're going to be looking at creation myths for this time and next time and probably the time following. Plesiadian. Oh, you got me again. I have to spell. Plesiadian.
Is that a country or a land's name?
It's all of the above. Was the founder of this people. It really gets to be an exciting thing because it gets into the one of the most mysterious myths that carries on to this day all over the world, because Plesiadis settled in a part of Greece that was called Arcadia. And all of the Arcadians in all of the different parts of the world, all the way from the Cajuns in New Orleans, there are Arcadians in every part of the world, and they're all, it becomes a sidereal myth also, because the Arcadians are supposedly, as much as they are children of Plesiadis, they are also children of Arcas, which is where the word Arcadian comes from. And, hi Jerry. And Arcas is the North Star. And it's a sidereal myth. The myth of the Arcadians has to do with the different realms as seen from the equator going up to the celestial North Pole. It's a most interesting story, but that's not the part we're looking at. So as Eurynome is dancing and whirling in space, she spins out the serpent. And the serpent is not only called Ophion, but the symbol of the serpent is also known as Boreas, being made of the north wind. And there is a tradition that the north wind is the wind of fertility. And that there has always been a tradition that horses and other animals that faced their rumps to the rear end could become impregnated without being inseminated by another animal. And being that Ophion was a rather lusty serpent, as serpents tend to be, and he coiled himself around her, and they danced together, and she was with child. And as she was with child, she needed more comfort. She couldn't really continue to dance that furiously, so she took the form of a dove. And it was a most unusual kind of dove because the dove rested on the waves. So at this point, all there is wind and water, and she is now resting as she is swelling as a gigantic dove. And out of that, she gives birth to a universal egg. It's a huge, big, most people consider it golden, though in some stories it's a silver egg. And this egg needs hatching, and she feels she's done her part by laying the egg, and so she commands Ophion to wrap himself around the egg. And so he wraps himself, coils himself 7 times around the egg and warms it. And after a given amount of time, the egg has come to term. And so it just splits right in half, and everything that we know in the world comes out of the egg. It's a rather telescoped story. It's, no, as you get down to the details, it just sort of cuts off really quickly. And so everything came out of that, or almost everything came out of that. And so the Earth being part of it, you know, all of the stars and planets and everything else came out of it. And she needed a home. And so she and Ophion settled at the top of Mount Olympus. And this is a very feminist creation myth. And what happens when they settle at Mount Olympus, when Ophion doesn't have much to say or much to do in the creative work, he starts bragging. And he starts bragging how he created the world and everything in it. And she doesn't like that because she thinks it's taking away from her glory. So what she does is she kicks all of his teeth out, which is why serpents to this day just have 2 fangs and nothing more, or a set of fangs and nothing more. And she bruises him up pretty bad, and she takes her heel, and she does a number on him with her heel, which can be an important symbol. And eventually she just kicks him out of Mount Olympus, and he goes off. And she goes back to dancing. Now, this is a very unusual story. When she goes back to dancing, this is when she creates the Titans as the planetary spirits. Remember when the first time we talked about all the Titans. And finally, when all of the gods are created, or the first generation of gods are created, she decides that she needs people. However, she made the earth such that the area of Arcadia was so fertile that people, Plessis first, followed by others, just sprang right out of the earth. And that was the first beginning of humanity. If you remember when we talked about Prometheus, the very first time we said that the first version of humanity sort of washed out, and there was a second version that was created by Prometheus out of earth. Okay, and that's the story. That's how it all began. According to the Plessigeans. Now let's go through the whole story again with mild commentary, because I don't want to get into all kinds of detail. I just want to mention that there are things so that this doesn't seem just like a childish story. There is a lot of information in it. It's certainly not an all all-fulfilling creation myth that tells you everything that's needed to know. The name Eurynome means wide-ranging, or like the spinning that she does is something that is a very, very great magnitude. Now, in almost all of the creation stories that come from the spiritual point of view, there was a state that always preceded cosmos, and that state was always a full state. There never was a time in all of the creation myths where there wasn't anything. And there wasn't a time when there wasn't the possibility of everything. And this state where all of the potential is available has always been called chaos. Chaos is like understanding potential in a demi-consciousness. It's not a total unconsciousness like the absolute, where nothing is known and it's totally unfathomable and it leads you on by the darkness of its mystery, but it's a quasi-state. It isn't something that's organized, and all of the relationships have not, possible relationships are more there than are ever become create. All of them have not been delineated. It's like saying that in creation there is a pre-cosmos state, and that pre-cosmos state has things that are eternal in it, and they are all run together, and they're all always there. Okay, and this disagrees with what every form of mysticism that I know of agrees with. Like, there is no idea of creating something from nothing. There always has been something there, but that something just hasn't been known. And the idea of having a complete empty space with nothing in it is probably an illusion that comes up from being too focused on matter and then thinking if one becomes, it's a sort of like a cycle of spiritual phenomenon that if you become too focused on the existence of one thing, then anything that isn't there seems empty, and it seems like a state of nothingness. So from a spiritual point of view, there's never been anything but a plenum, and a plenum is always a full space. She had no resting place, none whatsoever, and that is sort of the spirit of creation. Because when we're talking about creation, we're talking about any kind of creation. If we write, if we paint, or any act that we do in life, a mother who's carried a child knows that there really is no resting place. Your creation is with you all the time, and you have no rest from its weight. And there is no resting place. It talks about the psychological state that precedes creation. It's like saying, I'm uncomfortable. Like, I'm filled with something. I'm filled with this urge to give. I'm filled with this desire to pour out. And that kind of discomfort, I believe, is what is talked about when Eurynome finds herself coming out of chaos and is uncomfortable, uneasy. So when we talk about the sky being divided from the waters, we're talking about something. This is not to be taken literal. The one thing that is common to all creative myths, again, that was realized by all people, that if there is this unity, and in this unity there is, everything is all together, there can't be cosmos in that. In order to have cosmos, things have to be differentiated. And the most simple form of differentiation is polarity. So everything is divided into sky and water, one being a more active agent, one being a more resting or passive kind of element. And the reason I think that sky and water are chosen in the myth is in our everyday experience, they are the most subtle elements that we have. And the mythographer or the original tale teller of this myth wanted to just make it not, you know, like this isn't the division of heaven and earth, which would be a very gross distinction, having a really solid state and then having the invisible air. This is a division between air and water, which means that in this very early stage of coming out of chaos, there is a differentiation in substance and in polarity, and one is more active and one is more passive, but the states are very subtle states. Anybody who has ever tried to be in touch with things in the inner worlds, in the spiritual worlds, realizes just how subtle those things are. You can't hold on to them. It's something that takes a kind of consciousness that you have to spread your entire consciousness into the state that you want to go into and be in it, because you can't grab a hold of it. Like with perception in this world, you can look at an object and you can fix your consciousness on it and you can hold it there. But in the inner worlds, you can fix your attention, but what you're fixing your attention on is extremely subtle. And so what we're talking about with the division into sky and water is a subtlety, a very fluidic state. And she dances. The first motion, the primordial motion, is spinning. And that spinning, or the dancing that is talked about, is an expression of consciousness. All of the mystery teachers, like Plato, for example, said that movement or change represents a state of consciousness. Something that turns one way has one kind of consciousness. Something that turns another way has another kind of consciousness. And it seems axiomatic, at least from the mystical point of view, that there is no consciousness that does not express itself as a spinning movement in the cosmos. So in the same way that all of the orbs are spinning and all of the atoms are spinning, those are representations of consciousness. The direction and the frequency of rotation have to do with the state of consciousness. This is a universal mystical doctrine, and in that regard, mysticism does not differ much from physics, saying that all cosmos and everything in existence is in a state of motion. Not necessarily oscillation as much as spinning. And you know that clearly, for things to be brought out of chaos and condensed into reality, this involves on the part of the creative being a great concentration. And when one enters into a deep concentration or into a meditation or prayer, the deeper you go in, you become more peaceful in your spirit, but everything spins around you, most notably at the center of the forehead, like you start like a whirlpool going. And literally, within, you can do things like this. It's a demonstration of the old nebular theory of creation, that you can take the old round wash tub, you know, about 3.5-4 feet in diameter, and you can fill it with water, and you can put oil that floats on the top, and you can start it spinning. And what you do is you produce a center, and gradually the oil globules form like planets or little whirlpools at a given distance out from the center, in the same way that planetary spheres form within the solar system. The only difference is, in that case, is that the concentration of spin is coming from without, with a person with a stick or a paddle or something like that, whereas in the case of creation, whether it be on the part of the macrocosm or the very minute consciousness of an atom, it is something that comes from within. And so this is a fairly, you know, now we've looked at something that almost looks like a childish fairy tale, and it's pretty sophisticated. There is quite a bit of information there. Obviously, the hands, again, when she takes the wind and turns it in her hands, represents a conscious, manipulative consciousness. And the serpent itself represents that the spiral effect is being brought into account. Clearly, if there is no motion, everything is asleep. Everything is asleep in chaos, and everything is in darkness. If there were only spinning motion, there would not be any differentiation of time. There would not be any differentiation of direction, that is, of going forward. And so when you have the spiral, you have both a forward motion and you have a cyclical motion, and both are incorporated together. The eternal principles that repeat themselves again and again in cyclical fashion are not lost to creation, but when they are extended in time and space, it becomes the spiral principle or the serpentine principle, where the universal is not lost in the delineation or extension into the material. And so if you look at quite a few of creation myths, we're going to look at several of them tonight, that if you do that, you see that there are a large number of stories that have serpents in the beginning. So it's a kind of intelligence. And so she needs comfort. And so she rests. The egg represents now when the egg is laying, because if you think of Eurynome, and if you think of Ophion, you don't form a picture, or at least I don't. I don't form a human-like picture. If there is chaos and there is this whirling state in this chaos, and this can be delineated and turned into a spiral-like consciousness, things have not been differentiated. But when things get to the point that the creation becomes something definite, it represents a limitation to a given region of space, to a given region of time, and this containment saying that out of this chaos, this much I am going to condense. And this represents the egg. And the egg is almost perfect for creation because the egg has that whole quality of dividing within itself and dividing and differentiating within itself, and there is no external process. It's all internal. And see, like, we live inside of a closed system. We're inside of a cosmos. We can't escape the cosmos. Even in the notions of time and space in material science, we can't escape the cosmos. We are within. And to me, it's always a miracle. It's the thing that, you know, that kids do in classes when they're little tiny kids. They take an egg and they put it in an incubator, or they have a chicken with an egg, and you see that egg, it doesn't change, and it gets warm and it's warm. You can break open an egg and you can see that it's nothing but a yolk and a white. But you take the egg and it warms and keep it warm, and after a while that one cell has divided and redivided so many times, and each part of it has become something different, and from that one cell a chicken comes out. And that's not so that the whole dramatic idea of the egg breaking in half and everything is complete is not only very much telescoped, because this is not meant for a really sophisticated audience. myths aren't always meant for the intelligentsia, for them to have deep and profound concepts put before them. They are to take the concepts and present them in a way that is very simple. And in that simplicity, something works on the consciousness of the individual, and that individual can then be, can have within them incubating the principles. And so that's very often why the stories are simple. Okay. They eventually end up on Mount Olympus. And Mount Olympus, mountains, I think we've mentioned this before, and it's a fairly common notion that mountains represent high places. And high places are higher states of consciousness. And if there is a high relative to a solid concrete creation, there has to be a highest place. And that highest place, as is known by people, to the Greeks it was Mount Olympus. And that highest place represents sort of like the lightning rod where heaven and earth meet. It's as high as you can get, and it's filled with spiritual consciousness, and yet there is connection with the world of humans. The whole thing takes on a feminine bias. A lot of the extremely early myths, we're going to see that as we go on, are extremely feminist in nature. And that is because the first differentiation in the first parts of human creation, from the mystic's point of view, looking with the clairvoyance into the memory of nature, most of the leadership of humanity has been through those functioning through the feminine body. The spirits are male, female, and you might say omnisexual, but that when it comes into the body, you have the opportunity to be born both as male and female, and usually the early advances were made by the females, those who were in females' bodies, and when it comes to the very end, the middle part is ruled by males, or those in males' bodies, and then the very end again is ruled by females, when things will be done mostly by something like palingenesis, and it will not be necessary, not palingenesis, but what's the word for virgin birth? Parthenogenesis. Parthenogenesis. Yeah. That, and there won't be need for masculine insemination. We're talking about a long time in the future from now. So, I would think more in terms of tens of thousands of years, or maybe even hundreds of thousands of years. We're talking only, again, about the... I don't know.
And the Aquarius-Leo polarity of the age that's upon us at this point, with Leo being the opposite polarity, we'd be talking about enormous alterations in the childbearing and reproductive capacity.
Perhaps, yes. But for, how is it said in the Bible, who among you by taking thought can add one cubit to his stature? Changes that take place in the whole physical organism. I'm not talking about in vitro fertilization or artificial insemination or anything like that. I'm talking about the whole evolution of the physical organism. And that's not something that takes place overnight. It's something, you know, we may very well...
Since we're using genetic engineering now, probably maybe 100 years from now, we'll be able to genetically engineer that kind of organism.
I think that genetic engineering is something that, before it can go very far, it has to be... has to have an atom element of understanding the relationship of the physical to all of the other spiritual worlds wherein we live, and it isn't just a matter of manipulating matter. You can do some things by manipulating matter, but all you can do is make limitations of one kind or another. But to actually work in the realm of life itself is a much different matter.
The nature of life.
Yes. Something.
Besides, it's not Aquarius yet.
Well.
That's all the questions. Some people think it's started at the turn of the century, and some people not till 2300. So it's a matter of opinion. Depends which astrologers you're reading.
Astronomically, it's been calculated, hasn't it?
I don't want to get
into
it. I don't want to call it start a free for all.
We've always had cusps of between 150 and 300 years anyway.
Yeah, I don't want to start a free for all or be in a free for all or anything like that. But at any rate, this is something that dates from that very early time. And I think it is in accordance with the early nature of humanity. The early nature of humanity was much more creatively feeble. Very early, like in Lemuria and quite a while in Atlantis, we were still natural magicians because we were mostly focused from the inner worlds, but we were not really creators because we didn't have the Promethean fire within ourselves. And as we see the symbolism in the physical world, the feminine vehicle is a vehicle of receptivity. And therefore, to look at the whole early state of creation from the human point of view, where the humans have not mastered the world and become creative givers, but are to a large extent takers or receivers, it seems reasonable that the early outlook about the nature of the divine should be feminine, because that's what our consciousness was focused on. Okay, I don't want to talk about a whole lot of other things in here, because you can see that in each little thing you could go into great detail and that you could have all sorts of commentaries and interpretations and such like that. But one other thing that I do want to talk about, and that's at the very end of the myth, and that is the autophonian nature of man. Meaning that humans came out of the earth. And this is very, very common, even in the biblical mythology. Adam means humanity or human of red earth, meaning to say that we came out of the earth itself. This is not a radical, by the way, it's autophonian, and it's a word that you can have a lot of fun with. I do things like this to telephone operators. It is, if you're spelling something for a telephone, say you're spelling camp, for a telephone operator. C as in Thonian.
You'd do that, wouldn't you?
A as in aisle. M as in mnemonic. And P as in pneumatic. And about that time, the operator hangs up on you. You pull a few of those. The idea of autophonianism is that we are coeval with the cosmos. We grew up with the earth, and as the earth took a more dense form, we as humans took a more dense form. It is to say, like the bodies of evolving beings are within, going back to our egg again, are within the bodies of the creative beings.
And it's only in the same way that cells are within our bodies. And that when we do become separate, like if you know, like birds are lucky that way, they can even separate themselves in a way from the solid earth and even from the liquid earth, and they can fly, then our expanded consciousness spreads and our creations are within that. So the whole idea of autophonianism as part of a creative myth is not just, as the psychologists would say, some desire to avoid the concept of sexuality or something like that. You know, the psychoanalysts, according to them, everybody has sexual fears, and the whole idea of autophonian creation is such that people refuse to admit that their father was copulating with their mother, and that's where the whole notion of autophonianism comes from and such like that. It is indeed, from the mystical point of view, a spiritual fact that this is the way things occur, that the creator grows at the same time that the creation grows, which is something that everybody's experienced. No matter what you're doing as a creative work, you grow up as your creative work grows up. And from the viewpoint of the creation, you are within the creative work, and your differentiation comes along the way with it. Okay, so we've looked at our first little myth tonight, which is probably the most extensive. We're going to be really short tonight. We may only be as long as 1 hour, and then it will be all over with that quickly.
Sure.
No, I don't have a whole bunch to say tonight.
How many times have we heard that?
So this is it's sort of like a homely, commonplace kind of myth. It doesn't go into any exaggerations, and it doesn't go into anything unearthly, but yet there's enough subtlety, and there are enough pictures, and there's enough drama in it to hold our attention so that we can see the creative work of it. It's greatly telescoped, and there's probably a reason for that, because it's sort of assumed that people already know or are knowing about the material world and don't need all kinds of detailed explanations about that. And another reason for that is it could have all of the stages between the emergence of chaos within dark potential, that you could go into all kinds of, like if you get into the Vedanta metaphysics, you know, and you have Purushra and Prakriti and Maulu Prakriti, and then there are all sorts of stages in between there where matter is preconditioned and spirit is preconditioned, and for we are rather unsophisticated. But if we really awaken to a transcendental spiritual kind of consciousness, that we recognize that there are all sorts of very subtle but very important glories of spiritual consciousness. But since most people are, you know, in the time that the myths are originating, most people are not yet very intelligent, they're not yet very developed in either the physical world or in the inner worlds, they're not very developed. It's safe to telescope things in a rapid manner and be assured that later on, as people awaken and deepen and expand their consciousness, that all of those distinctions will become more important. What looks like straining at a gnat at another time becomes a very, very important distinction. Especially, you know, you take simple things like telling the truth is much different than not lying. And that may sound like a trivial, petty Virgo kind of statement to do, but when there come to be circumstances where not lying is one means of functioning that's very important, which is very, very much different from telling the truth. And so those kinds of things go on like that. It's satisfactory for our feelings. It's not very satisfactory for our thinking, because obviously, the people weren't heavy thinkers at that time, but having some sort of feeling. In the same way that if you're telling a story to a child, you can frighten that child, and it's very important to have a mythology almost as a psycho-spiritual nest for a child in telling tales to a child. So it was for early humanity. It was enough to give something to satisfy the feelings so that there was a comfort, as if there were a reason for all of this and something that pictures could be formed, and those pictures were as satisfactory as a lot of logical explanations, and that was good enough for the myth. Okay, let's look at a few other points of view. I'm going to do something I rarely ever do in class. I'm going to read, and it's something I do very poorly. And I have brought in some of my mythology books. I have several shelves full of them. I like these very much. There are modern renditions of them. They're by Robert Graves for the Greek myths. Robert Graves is the fellow, I don't know if he's alive anymore. He was a creative writer, a very excellent creative writer. He wrote something that they made a movie out of, which was really hard to make a movie out of. It was called The Shout. He wrote, which was from one of his short stories, and they made a pretty good movie out of it. But beside being a writer, he was a fellow of the Royal Archaeological Society for when he wrote these books. They have a lot of material in them that is archaeological explanation of myths. But he was pretty tedious about going into original source material to get a lot of viewpoints of the myths, but they don't read terribly bad because he was a creative writer. He can write in such a way that they're readable. In fact, later on, after he had become a royal fellow, in interviews he revealed how he got some of the information, some of the archaeological information. It turned out that he was a quasi-involuntary clairvoyant. And what he would do is he would hold the mythical theme in his mind, and he would look at a blank wall or at a sheet or something like that, and then he would recall things from Greek history and have the pictures appear on the sheet or in his consciousness. And this is where he got some of his archaeological interpretations. They make them in a much more classy kind of book now. I don't think they're called Penguin. I think they're called Pelican. Editions, but they're all right. I like them. This is about a 25-year-old version, so I'll just read a couple of other shorty creative myths out of here just to show you what's the differences of various types of them.
Who's telling the myths?
Robert Graves is telling the myths. He draws from all sorts of sources. He has, there are loads and loads of notes, and then there are also loads and loads of references. The bibliography is right in with him. The Homeric and Orphic creation myths. Some say that all the gods and all living creatures originated in the stream of Oceanus, which girdles the world, and that Tethys was the mother of all his children. But the Orphics say that black-winged Night, a goddess of whom even Zeus stands in awe, was courted by the wind and laid a silver egg in the womb of darkness, so that Eros, who some call Phanes, was hatched from this egg and set the universe in motion. Eros was double-sexed and golden-winged, and having four heads, sometimes roared like a bull or a lion, sometimes hissed like a serpent or bleated like a ram. Night, who named him Eristhephaeus and Protogenes Phaeton, lived in a cave with him, displaying herself in triad, Night, Order, and Justice. Before this Night, Order, and Justice. Before this cave sat the inescapable Mother Rhea, playing on a brazen drum and compelling man's attention to the oracles of the goddess. Phanes created earth, sky, sun, and moon,
but the triple goddess ruled the universe until her scepter passed to Uranus. And that's the dual. We're obviously not going to tackle that one because there's all sorts of things run together in that. A couple of others, and then we'll just pass on. We're almost ready to close. At the beginning of all things, Mother Earth emerged from chaos and bore her son Uranus as she slept. Gazing down fondly at her from the mountains, he showered fertile rains upon her secret clefts, and she bore grass, flowers, and trees, with the beasts and the birds proper to each. The same rain made the rivers flow and filled the hollow places with water so that the lakes and seas came into being. Her first children of semi-human form were the hundred-handed giants Briares, Gyges, and Cotys. Next appeared the three wild, one-eyed cyclops, builders of gigantic walls and master smiths, formerly of Thrace, afterwards of Crete and Lycia, whose sons Odysseus encountered in Sicily. Their names were Brontes, Steropes, and Arges, and their ghosts have dwelt in the caverns of the volcano Etna since Apollo killed them in revenge for the death of Aesculapius. The Libyans, however, claim that Garmas was born before the 100-handed ones, and that he rose from the plain. He offered the Mother Earth a sacrifice of sweet acorn. That's another version. Some say that darkness was first, and from darkness sprang chaos. From a union between darkness and chaos sprang night, day, Erebus, and the air. From a union between night and Erebus sprang doom, old age, death, murder, continence, sleep, dreams, discord, misery, vexation, nemesis, joy, friendship, pity, the three fates, and the three Hesperides. From a union between air and day sprang Mother Earth, sky, and sea. From a union between air and Mother Earth sprang terror, craft, anger, strife, lies, oaths, vengeance, intemperance, altercation, treaty, oblivion, fear, pride, battle. Also Oceanus, Metis, and the other Titans, Tartarus, and the three Erinnes or Furies. From a union between Earth and Tartarus sprang the giants. From a union between the sea and its rivers sprang the Nereids. But as yet there were no mortal men. With the consent of the goddess Athene, Prometheus, son of Iapis, formed them in the likeness of gods. He used clay and water of Panopas and Infoses, and Athena breathed life into them. This is the other philosophical creation myth. Others say that the god of things, whoever he may have been, for some call him nature, appeared suddenly in chaos, separating earth from heaven, water from the earth, and the upper air from the lower. Having unraveled the elements, he set them in due order as they are now found. He divided the earth into zones, some very hot, some very cold, others temperate, molded into it into plains and mountains, and clothed it with grass and trees. Above it he set the rolling firmament, spangled it with stars, and assigned stations to the four winds. He also peopled the waters with fish, the earth with beasts, and the sky with the sun, moon, and the five planets. Lastly, he made man, who alone of the beasts raises his face to heaven and observes the sun, the moon, and the stars. Unless it indeed be true that Prometheus, the son of Iapetus, made man's body from water and clay, and that his soul was supplied by certain wandering divine elements which had survived from the first creation. All right. Yes, yes. Even I, who cannot read well, do better than normal.
Good.
Yeah.
Well, you'll have to prove that you don't read well. We'll find you another book to read.
Clearly, we see from looking at these second four myths, second grouping of four myths, that there is not universal agreement about how things came to be. There's not universal agreement about a lot of spiritual things. But that doesn't mean that there isn't a universal truth to spiritual things. In fact, the more one truly gives oneself to spiritual study, a bipolar experience occurs within such a one. That on one hand, one sees more and more different viewpoints, sees the same truth from all kinds of different ways, but yet at the same time finds a common unity with other people that are doing things that appear on the outside to be very different. And so I think it is with creation myths. I don't think all of the myths were in the hands of initiates. And that I don't think that all of the mythographers, be they poets or storytellers, were always in touch with the divine wisdom. And sometimes these things came to be corrupted by poor memory and wrong attitudes by people. But even if the origin wasn't always correct, and even if the stories themselves were modified, that doesn't mean that there isn't a common unity. Because if you look, if you take something as objective as a human horoscope, you can give that horoscope to every person in the room and have them say, you don't even need a horoscope, just have somebody do something. We could take any person in this room, and each person could write down what they thought that person had done and why they had done it, and each person would have a different rendition of it. But that wouldn't mean that any of them were wrong. Each one would see a different point of view, and each one maybe would have some misperceptions, but each one would add to the total truth of it. You know, like right now, we have very limited consciousness. And especially when we're trying to think of something so grand, so profound as the creation of the cosmos, clearly our minds are not adequate to understand that. You know, when we get involved with spiritual things, the first things we want to know are, what's the reason for all of this? Why is it like this? Or why did God create the world like this? And those are the answers that should come at the end and not at the beginning. Or if they do come at the beginning, you just hang on to them until the end, because the mind as it is now, the consciousness of a human being as it is now, is much too small. It's much too materialistic. We can't expect to get answers that will be totally satisfying. It's sort of like we have to give birth to the universal understanding in ourselves. We have to grow into a cosmic consciousness, and not that a cosmic consciousness is given to us in the same way that a plate of beans is given to us. It's of that kind of order that things go. So that's sort of what one expects. And on top of that, there is always the big problem that comes with the difference between the language and the subject. When you're talking about the spiritual world, you're talking about something very otherworldly. But when we're talking about the language that we express it through, it is very worldly. And so it's like trying to put something greater into something lesser. It's a very difficult thing. Like if you have some kind of inward poetic experience, to take and put it into words, written or spoken, is not an easy process, especially when you're trying to take a truth that is very rare and very subtle and present it to people who are not ready for it. So it's not surprising that the myths would be crude. All of these myths that we looked at clearly recognize polarity as part of creation, as a simple differentiation. All of these myths recognize stages. We've talked about them before, and next week we're going to talk a little bit about them again. The stages are sometimes mentioned in generations, that this generation of gods succeeds this generation of gods in such, or this divinity will associate itself with this nature force, and out of that something else will be born. So what we understand from this in terms of creation, it begins with a polar differentiation. One is at least divided into two, and two means many can come from that. And that between the unity and the multifarious differentiation of the world as we know it now, into all of the atoms and particles and everything that's in it, in just the material level, there are many stages. And that says something if we want to experience this ourselves through something meditative or through something of an inward consciousness, that must also be staged. That if we come into one realization of consciousness, we can't stop there. We have to always be expectant that beyond and behind that is another stage of consciousness. And truly, all of the myths are capable of being understood on different levels. In a few weeks, when we start coming to myths that have been used by the mystery schools, we're going to look at one from at least two or three different levels and see how it means the opposite thing on one level from the next. Okay. All of them have a co-evolution of humanity with the body of creation. But then things differentiate, and they differentiate according to character type. If you look at the Homeric and the Olympian and the Orphic creation myths, the way we looked at those, or if you look at those myths again, they're filled with pictures. And those pictures are very irrational. They contain things that one perceives by seeing an event in the world. When you see an event in the world, there's a whole jumble of feelings. So clearly, those kinds of myths are meant for one type of consciousness, a kind of consciousness that the vehicle and the completed picture is the way that communication takes place. The last two myths, especially the one where they were the enumeration of all of these different kinds of evils, mostly, it makes me wonder about the mythographer who wrote that, all of these curses and everything else. Those are much more abstract. For those are for a recognition that there are principles. And for such an individual, the principle is all important, and it could be in any number of pictures. And so we have the two types of consciousness, or the two parts of consciousness. We have the division of heaven and earth again in the consciousness of the individual. In terms of spiritual unfoldment, the mystery schools teach that both are absolutely necessary. That a thought that is only an invisible abstract meaning is incomplete. And one can suffer psycho-spiritual damage in terms of growth by not following through on the creation such that the meaning bears fruit in some objective end. The other danger is that one can only have the imagination and one can think that the receptacle or that the form is the truth and not the bearer of the truth. Therefore, for any kind of complete understanding of anything, for any kind of unfoldment in terms of spiritual consciousness, one must have the truth, but that truth must bear fruit as it sees its way into imaginations. And in that process, the truth is itself, I would say, corrected or fulfilled. And this is part of a total creative consciousness. And so clearly the myths that we see are of two natures. In between this are intelligences. There are abstract truths and there are forms. And the divinities, if you notice in both of these myths, the divinities can go into the forms or they can mate with the principles. And so we have here then truth and form and an intelligence that works through both of them, and that the triad of understanding, that the intelligence is the creative being that does the work. And so this is a very important point in terms of spiritual unfoldment, that on one hand we can look to spiritual awakening, or we can look to material completion, but we are neither the spirit nor the form, we are the consciousness. You know, it's as a friend of mine says, it's like the there is the light that passes through the particles so that you see the particles of dust. You know what I'm talking about? If you're in a room and it's a darkened room like an old barn and a shaft of light comes through a crack and you can see the light, but what you're really seeing is the dust. And you can, and the spirit matter pole is like that. There can be forms that are more or less gross matter or more or less rarely spiritual, but it is the light that illumines both of those, and that the light is associated with waking consciousness. And so what is implicitly within all of these creation myths is a spiritual truth. Okay, now, why are we as mysteries students, because we have a few new guests tonight, and the name of this course is Mythology and the Mysteries. We're not trying to be psychologists and we're not trying to be poets, we're trying to look at the myths in terms of mystery wisdom. Why are we looking at creation myths? Because, the answer would be, because in the same way that we are part of the gods and we can't really separate ourselves from the unity, we are all part of the creation. And in the mystery schools, as one unfolds waking consciousness, one remembers one's history. What we are, even to the very way that we think and the capability of thinking, has been built into us by the creation. And unless we understand the creative process, we're likely to think that our consciousness is the only consciousness that can be. And we're likely to live in a kind of philosophical solipsism that anything that doesn't live outside of our consciousness doesn't exist. The studying of creation myths is the studying of our history, and as we move out of the state of being creatures and become creators, we will take out from within our being what has been planted in there in the creative process, and we will give it out creatively, and we become then individual, free, creative beings. But we can't take out what hasn't come in. We'll talk about some of the principles of that maybe next time. But all of the stages of creation and everything that went into it is what we are. And you can't skip grades, so to speak. You live it through. And therefore, in the study of creation myths, in the study of cosmogony and cosmology, we find out what we are and how we became what we are, so that if we know what we are, then we can unfold that and fulfill it and become free, and free as created beings. I have a lot more on that, but I will pass on a lot of it because it is getting long. I didn't think it was going to be that long. Gee whiz, this always happens to me. The creation that we live in, it is surprising to me, is both...
But we're not surprised.
...is both a creation and an experiment. That is, we're filled with something to create, and yet it is not known to us, and it's an experiment. And this is true on every level, all the way to the level of the One. Throughout the whole cosmos, one might even say that in the highest sense, the Supreme Being is also experimenting. The experimentation there is in a much different spirit, and certainly at a much different level of intelligence, but it is essentially no different than our experimentation and our creation. The same spirit wherewith we try to discover things is the same thing that's going on in the cosmos. And if we can keep... See, what I'm a votary of informality. You know, I'm not going to stand up here with a shirt and tie and do all of that sort of thing. And we'll have, you know, like a formal syllabus, and everybody has to follow this rigid form. And I feel that that's important because that's the way the spirit is kept alive. You know, this is a matter of life. And when telling these stories, the thing that's most important is that that life of experimentation, that lusty life of Jovian creation, is not lost, because that is the way we actually fulfill what we're in and what we're doing. Okay, so one thing that I want to talk about a little bit from the viewpoint of the mysteries, I've got all kinds of things here that I could talk about, and that is that, yeah, this is the whole meat of the lecture is lost for what was coming to the build-up to it, because I hate being so long. The unity that pervaded the original chaos is not lost ever. Horizontally, at any stage, at any level, at any realm, that unity is maintained through the principle of cause and consequence, which are two sides of a silhouette which describe the same full reality. And therefore, when we're looking at the myths, we must remember that everything that happens of a causal nature, every event that is in there, every cause and consequence is part of that. On a vertical level, the unity is also maintained, and it's maintained by the principle of analogy. As above, so below, what has gone before in heaven will follow after on earth. Know this and rejoice. Meaning to say that the same creative principles apply whether it is in the creation of the cosmos, or in making love and bearing children, or in creating a recipe. The same principles apply. And the more of these creative formulae we can derive either from reading creation myths or from reading cosmogony and cosmology, the more we are able to successfully work our creations into an analogous fashion so that everything that we do is microcosmic to the way that the divine functions in the universe. And so this is sort of like a step forward in logic, in the same way that we said in the earlier talks that that myths are to be taken almost completely literally, because they talk about the divine, about the realms of the gods and such like that. Now we are part of that creation. And if we look at the episodes in different myths, we'll take some episodes. I'm thinking of doing Perseus, and I'm thinking maybe of doing Siegfried, and I'm certainly going to do East of the Sun and West of the Moon right around solstice time, because it's an excellent heroine myth. And it's a folk tale rather than a myth. We'll maybe talk about the difference between the two, but... the more we fill ourselves with that kind of consciousness, and the more that we can see that there are progressive stages of consciousness, the better we will be in our forward going. All right. A couple more little points, and then we have two last myths to tell. Oh, I guess we've covered those points. I want to give you what I consider, I don't even know the source of this last myth, of one of these last myths, but it above all others, describes in about four lines stages of creation that are the most succinct transcendental creative formula that I've seen anywhere. I'll just tell you, I've got it written in four lines. The first thing in creation was darkness or night. The first thing created by darkness was love or the light. The first thing created by love was the law. And from that, all else was created. I've never seen a creative myth done better than that. If one ponders on that creation myth alone until it's riveted in the consciousness, both the antecedents and succedents of the stages and principles, I don't think one can fail in a spiritual life. Then I have one last myth, which is a really hard creation story to tell. Yes. Cause and consequence, horizontally and vertically. I think that's why I interpret it. I didn't write the myth, so I can't say.
Can you read it again?
Yes. The first thing in creation was darkness or night. The first thing created by darkness was love or light. The first thing created by love was the law. And from that, all things else were created. All right, now a really tough myth, really hard. It's a tooth-gnashing myth. There was a first, very minute moment of time. In that moment, all matter was packed infinitely close in one point, and all of the rest of space was empty. It exploded and expanded and continues to expand into seemingly endless space. The matter differentiated itself into various grades, particles, and from that emanated various energies. The exploding matter is found in various groupings and various different associations based on principles of physics. They include galactic clusters, galaxies, star spheres, stars, planets, satellites, meteors, grandules, molecules, atoms, subatomic particles, and sub-subatomic particles. Some of the states of matter, called atomic elements, form molecules and interact with each other, combining and recombining to form compounds and other compounds. In at least one case, the compounded matter randomly found conditions suited to produce compounds that reproduce organized forms. These organized forms went through a series of changes based on chance and consequences of principles that appear operative in the external environments. They became complicated organizations with the power to move, etc. The organizations are manifold in variety. Some of these complicated evolved organizations undergo chemical interactions such that they experience something called consciousness, which has the appearance of vitality, emotion, desire, thought, and communication. In these chemical interactions, which are both accidental and determined by blind principle, there is a state that has the appearance of knowing both the blind principles and the accidents, so that their communication of their random determined experience, called arguments, are neither blind nor determined, but something called free objective knowledge, which is nowhere to be found in the whole sequence of accidents and deterministic principles. Now I ask you, who has the superstitious creative myth? That's it. Next time we're going to look at Judeo-Christian creation myths in both the Old and New Testament, and maybe the apocalypse. I'm not sure. It all depends on how much time I have and how much daring I have. Obviously, the last myth was not from one mythographer, but from a collection, a collaboration. Yeah, I did. Gritting my teeth every step of the way.